Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This is Radio Boston's Week in Review. I'm Tiziana Deering. A push and pull this week between things that went right and a world where so much is still wrong.
You better prosecute the police! No justice, no peace!
Demonstrations in Boston this week after Derek Chauvin is found guilty of murdering George Floyd, even as police shoot Andrew Brown Jr. in North Carolina and Makia Bryant in Ohio. And we learned more details of what Boston police knew and when in the case of an officer accused of multiple accounts of child sexual abuse. Acting Mayor Kim Janey, under fire from other mayoral candidates, says it's more important to figure out exactly how that happened, but won't release more documents from the case.
The focus is on the process. We will not re-victimize survivors in this case. This is not about pointing fingers. This is understanding what happened in terms of the process.
And in the pandemic, while restrictions begin to loosen all around us, Massachusetts is staying the course as coronavirus variants keep a grip on our Commonwealth.
I think it's important for us to move at a pace to make sure that the reopening process we pursue is one that's consistent with the guidance and the recommendations we're getting from the experts and doesn't create a bounce in the wrong direction with respect to surge and additional cases and hospitalizations.
Join us this hour to talk about all of it. And folks, we are going to start with local police reform. Has Boston gone far enough with transparency in the Patrick Rose case? What about transparency and accountability in your local police department? What's the relationship between your local department and your community? 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK to join the conversation. And our panelists this week, Tito Jackson, former Boston City Councilor, mayoral candidate in 2017, and now CEO of Verdant Medical, and Tom Nichols. He's a professor of national security affairs at the U.S. Naval War College in Newport, Rhode Island, and a contributing writer at The Atlantic. Tito and Tom, welcome.
Good to be with you.
Thank you for having me.
Great to have you both. I want to start specifically with the Patrick Rose case, and I want to recap this briefly for our listeners. Former Boston police officer Patrick Rose is accused of child sexual abuse in the case of six children. The Globe broke a story about prior child abuse allegations against Rose in 1995. He was not charged, but the department determined he'd likely committed a crime at that time. He then served another 20 years on the force and served as president of the Boston Police Patrolmen's Association. Last week, Acting Mayor Kim Janey vowed a speedy release of the internal investigation files. The city released them on Tuesday. That happened just as the verdict in the Chauvin murder trial was coming out. They released 13 pages of documentation out of 105 pages total. Tito, what do you see as the headline from what we now know?
That the Boston police absolutely, completely dropped the ball. And up until, you know, essentially a month ago, continued to stonewall getting the right information to the right people for accountability. It is absurd and debatably criminal as to what actually happened in this situation. The inaction by the internal aspects of the Boston police, as well as multiple administrations, really helped this predator continue to be a predator. And one of the cases just really struck at my heart, where there was two generations that Patrick Rose had abused, and a father as well as a daughter. This calls for, and I compliment the leadership of Mayor Kim Janey on this. She acted swiftly. She's been mayor, I don't know, has it been a month? And acted swiftly. And I actually, it bothers me when I hear past police commissioners, instead of taking responsibility and dealing with the fact that there are young people who have been victimized on their watch based on their actions, saying that, hey, it wasn't my fault. It's not on me. Well, you know what? Say that to those parents. Say that to those young people. And I don't think you, that those folks have any standing when it comes to attacking the mayor of the city of Boston, Kim Dane. I think she's done a good job thus far. I think the addition of Stephanie Everett is a critical component, and we must get to the bottom of this. And this is just the tip of the iceberg around the lack of transparency in the Boston Police Department.
Okay, so everyone, Tito has just framed up for us all the threads that we could follow in this conversation. Listeners, if you want to pick up on any of them and react, the number is 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Tom Nichols, the thread I'm going to pick up on to turn to you first. Tito called out former police leadership for their reactions here. Former Commissioner Paul Evans is joining some unlikely allies and calling for release of all the documents. As we said, only 13 pages were released. The city says they're not going to give any more information than the redacted set did about, and they say that if they did give any more pages, it wouldn't give any more information about who knew what when, that all the remaining pages really deal with the identities and the complaints of the victims. Is that a satisfying answer? And does it also raise concerns that the remaining documents can't be released? Many people now are calling for them all to be released.
It's not a satisfying answer to me. And again, a reminder, I don't represent the War College or the Navy in any of this. The part of this that I find stunning, and part of the reason I find that such an unsatisfying answer, you almost become numb to corruption in large organizations, no matter where it is. And, you know, if this had been a case where somebody said, well, this guy was, I don't know, shaking down storefronts, or that his brother officers, and sister officers covered for him because he got rough with a defendant, and you'd say, this is terrible, needs to be an investigation. But for this kind of, circle the wagons mentality about child abuse, I mean, that was the part that really jumped out at me. I mean, you sort of get used to seeing, unfortunately and sadly, to say, well, there are corrupt officers, they get charged with things. But the idea that, that this will stop with document releases. I mean, there are a way to do document releases. You can have a committee of people who are convened or impaneled to do this and to look at these and to vet them for public release. I don't know what's in them. I can't prejudge the release of a document I haven't seen, but simply to say, okay, that's it. We're not going any further. If this were an ordinary case of corruption, I suppose, you could argue about that. But this kind of situation with multiple accusations of child sexual abuse, I just don't think that cuts it. And I think that was the part that was really shocking, that this went on for so long. You expect a certain amount of thin blue line behavior, but not on this.
So I want to actually play a piece of sound. We talked with District Attorney Rachel Rollins, Suffolk County DA, this week, and she told us that there's just no way that the accusations against Rose were not known across the department. Here she is.
I can tell you, police departments gossip more than middle schools. So I know all of those people knew about the allegations against this man, whether sustained, and they were, or not, and they still elected him to lead them.
And Tito, that gets to Tom's comparison of the culture of secrecy around child sexual abuse, which certainly resonates deeply here in Boston with the history of the Catholic Church. And it also resonates with conversations we're having about the way law enforcement protect each other and themselves. I guess I just want to ask you if you're surprised to hear what D.A. Rollins said.
No, I'm not. There's no way that people did not know about this, which was actually in his file. And I would also note the silence of the Boston Police Patrol Persons Union is deafening. It's absolutely deafening right now. In multiple newspaper stories that I've read, no comment. So this is, and I would say, and we're going to talk about Black Lives Matter movement and violence and the like. This is what folk are talking about. You have the person who should be most angered by a bad cop, in particular someone who hurts children, is a good cop. The people that we want to hear stand up and say that this is wrong are those good cops who are out there. And at this point, what we're hearing is actually silence. And I know in my heart of hearts that I don't believe that there's anyone on the force that thinks this is right. But your silence is a portion of violence, and it perpetuates these issues. Stand up, have a backbone, and call out what's wrong. And I would say, one of the things that we saw from Mayor Janey is you saw swift action. I don't know how many pages, and I'm not a lawyer. I don't play one on TV. But when it comes down to it, there was action that happened with swiftness in comparison to multiple administrations that continued to kick the can down the road. Stand up and show us that you are the people who on a day-to-day basis protect us and serve us, in particular, our children.
So I've got a couple colors I want to go to, but because of what you just said, Tito, I'm going to stay with you for a minute. I'm going to push back a little. Boston City Councilor Andrea Campbell, who is running, and Acting Mayor Kim Janey also running, called out the release of these documents really buried in the news cycle because they came in tandem with the Derek Chauvin verdict. Is there an accountability issue there? I mean, we know about the Friday evening news dump, and it's something people call administrations out on.
I think that call out is bogus. And the reason why I think that call out is bogus is both of them were city councilors at the same time. They both had access, and actually, this piece, and to the credit of folks at in particular the Globe, who've been doing a lot of this work, they had that information. When given the opportunity to actually make this call, that information was done swiftly. Right. And regardless of what was happening in the news cycle, the fact that it actually came out in a swift fashion, I think, is the most important. And I think it's actually the most important thing to those parents. And then also we need to go back and find out who works in these departments, who made these decisions, who are still there, who's been promoted, who've actually touched this. And should those people in those departments be part of the current leadership? And again, it's not a long time ago. And sadly, when I was on the council, the last contract, this is the person who was actually in power in the police union.
Patrick
Rose. Can't stand. And
Shoot. Tito, we are losing your sound. I want to hear the rest of what you had to say, but we are losing your sound. So I'm going to step away from you for a minute. Tom, I want to go to the phones, and then I'm going to turn to you. 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK to join this conversation. Let's start with Mary in Braintree. Mary, what's on your mind?
I am tired of men, whether they're priests, elected officials, government officials, getting away with abusing children. We need better legal options and mechanisms for children to step up and not be afraid.
Thank you for that, Mary. And I'm going to grab one more call. We've got Bonnie in Tingsboro. Bonnie, go ahead.
Hi, I just wanted to just speak out how grateful we are that in Tingsboro we have a wonderful police chief, Howe, who has spoken in support of the George Floyd protests. And even more recently, he actually recommended that we have one of our animal control officers fired. And this animal control officer had posted Islamophobic postings about, Facebook postings about shooting protesters, all these kinds of really nasty things. And in return for that, our police chief was actually dragged into kind of a nasty hearing where he was admonished for being too public and for just being too transparent. And it was just really sad to see the Board of Selectmen, Rault and Wernerstrom were just not backing him up.
All right. Thank you for that, Bonnie. So I take a couple things out of that, Tom Nichols. One is about local voice and local leadership. Both of those callers were either damning or praising choices to speak out in these tough moments, and mm-hmm. also the consequences of speaking out. And before those calls, Tito was calling on officers who have been quiet to speak out. I'm also thinking about comments by the former president of the Massachusetts Association of Minority Law Enforcement Officers, Larry Ellison, during this, expressing frustration over how hard it is to push for change from the inside. So what structures need to be in place? What practices do we need to see from local departments to make, speaking out doable?
Well, first things first, I think on this, this is not just a normal case of how difficult it is to speak out. I mean, the difficulty of speaking out is when you have a thorny problem where there are many sides and you're trying to resolve how to do things like effective community policing. This should not be a hard case. This is an accused, at least according to these charges, an accused serial child predator. This isn't a should I speak out or not moment. The bigger issue here, I think, is that, and one of the things, again, that I find stunning, having had a couple of cops in my family over the years, is that this was the head of the union. And this is an opportunity, I think, for people across the political spectrum to actually start having a productive conversation about police unions. Because it's interesting to note that my friend Tim Miller, who writes at the Bulwark, has pointed out conservatives don't like unions and liberals want police reform. Well, okay, it looks like there's an obvious place to start, which is, are police unions part of the problem? Maybe this is something to look at, because when you have somebody who's been protected like this, who becomes the head of a union, that itself should make everybody stop in their tracks and to say, how did that happen? And I think there's plenty of area for debate and, for reforming some of these institutions. And I think that's probably one place to start.
I want to stay on this idea of reforming institutions and systems. I know, Tito, we have you back. I want to play some sound from you. On Wednesday, we heard from Boston Globe senior opinion writer and WBUR contributor Kimberly Atkins. She was responding to a caller who had called in about weeding out the bad police officers and respecting the good. Here was part of her answer.
We are seeing the results of that broken system, which has so many inherent biases that criminalizes Black folks from jump. But this isn't an idea that we're just focusing on a few bad apples. This is an idea that we are focusing on a broken system that puts everyone in danger.
So you have served in the Boston City Council. You did run for mayor. What are, let's say, two levers, Tito, that the city needs to push on to make systems level change in policing?
I think one of the systems level change components is now in play, the Office of Police Accountability, having an opportunity and essentially a board that will allow folks to be able to review cases, that has actual subpoena power and has teeth. In the past, there was a three-member board that had no subpoena power and simply was a waste of time. So I think that's a critical component. I also think this ability to be able to get rid of folk who have actually stepped way out of bounds. And so I think this component around ensuring that there's actually accountability for those individuals, and these individuals don't get punted from one area to another. I think there's a couple of pieces that we have to deal with there. And I think just the third piece is that looking at the disparity. There are hundreds of Black police officers who have been kicked out of the force for things that their white their white colleagues have actually done the same. And so I think this component around ensuring that there's actually equity in this area of discipline, as Larry Ellison brings up time and time again and has had to face with members of MAMREO.
Okay, I'm going to go to a break, but before I do, let's just pick up one more call on this subject. We've got Richard on the line in South Boston. Richard, go ahead.
Couldn't they charge him under federal statutory child molestation charges under federal statutes?
Oh, that's an interesting question. So actually, Tom, none of us are lawyers, but Richard is raising a question, which is, why is this restricted to state charges? Is there a federal case to be made here? And should we be thinking about something like that, Tom Nichols?
Well, I'm I'm not a lawyer, and I'm not a an expert on federal law, so I don't know. My instinct as a good proponent of federalism is that unless there is overwhelming reason for the federal government to intrude on the state, that states should be able to handle their own discipline about things like police forces, unless there is such massive corruption that the federal government, has some interest in stepping in, whether there's some, legal principle or whether there's a law that actually governs this. I don't know. But my gut feeling is before we say that the city of Boston or the Commonwealth can't handle this, maybe, we ought to stop for a moment and think about whether we can do this ourselves.
We're talking about a week where there were some things that went right, but in a world where it feels like much is still wrong. Still with us, our guest, former Boston City Councilor Tito Jackson and The Atlantic's Tom Nichols. And you, listeners, before the break, we were talking about local police reform. We do want to spend a few minutes now talking about national policing and capturing our feelings this week with so much going on in the news around policing, police violence, police convictions. I want to start with two perspectives from Boston we heard earlier this week after the conviction verdict in the Derek Chauvin trial. Here's Al Action from South Boston and Michael Terry in Roxbury.
Tears of joy. When I heard the verdict, I cried. I cried.
Can you imagine somebody doing that to you? You're begging for your life, the police. I'm just glad it was done. It's not going to bring him back, but you can't just go around murdering people. And you're supposed to protect and serve.
Where are you, listeners, and how are you feeling at the end of an exhausting and painful week? A victory in many's eyes around the verdict for Derek Chauvin. Killings of Andrew Brown Jr. in North Carolina and Makia Bryant in Columbus at the hands of police. Conversations about national police reform, local police reform. Let's just talk with each other. And Tom and Tito, I want to give you each a chance to react to the guilty verdict in the Chauvin trial this week. Judge Nancy Gertner made it clear to us that that verdict is going to reverberate here at home. Tom Nichols, how are you feeling about it?
I was both shocked and pleasantly surprised. I given the outcomes of a lot of high-profile trials over the years, I thought almost certainly that this was going to be a hung jury, that somebody was going to just dig in. And I'm really relieved that, the jury said it gave me a little faith back in the jury system, because my faith in the jury system has been shaken over the years for a lot of reasons. And the idea that 12 people saw what we all saw. I thought it was very effective for the prosecutor simply to say, this case is exactly what you think it is. It's exactly what it looks like. Because I think that was the thing about the video when this happened almost a year ago, where, millions of Americans looked at it and said, there just isn't any other way to see this. And I think had the jury reached some other verdict, it would have been appalling to think that people looked at that video and saw something else. So I'm relieved, and it also gave me a bit more faith in the jury system.
Tito Jackson, as I turn to you, I want to play a little sound for you. We had a conversation just after, the day after the verdict this week, talking about the difference between accountability and justice. And here is Imari Paris Jeffries, who's executive director of King Boston, reflecting on that.
While there was a relief that accountability occurred, I can't say that justice was fully executed on. It's like taking a shower in a mud pit. We're getting clean on top, but we know that half of our body is still involved in the muck.
So I've that's stuck with me for the rest of the week, Tito, and I want to turn to you and ask you how you're thinking about things.
I cried also. Amari is spot on. We are still soiled as a people, as a country, and in particular with how we treat black and brown bodies. The prosecutor did an amazing job, and I agree with Tom, in the framing. And I think the concept that sticks out to me is when the prosecutor brought up that it is said that George Floyd died because George Floyd's heart was too large, that he had an enlarged heart. But he countered with, George Floyd didn't die because he had too large of a heart. He died because Derek Chauvin had too small of a heart. And I think it's really critical and drawing this line around accountability versus justice, which would be able to bring him back, meaning George Floyd. And then also the juxtaposition of what happened a half an hour before we heard this verdict, where a 16-year-old girl was fatally shot in Columbus, Ohio, Makia Bryant. And this component that we have in our country that we see time and time again, white folk who kill people, with Dylann Roof, who killed a bunch of black folk and then was brought to Burger King. White bodies who have killed someone but still are unscathed post their interaction, sometimes even harming, stabbing police, hitting them with cars, stealing cars, and the like. That juxtaposition is palpable now. It was one of those situations where you hold your breath, but it really brings to mind one of the things that a friend shared with me out of a book called The Talmud, and it says, do not be daunted by the enormity of the world's grief. Do justly now, love mercy now, walk humbly now. You are not obligated to complete the work, but neither are you free to abandon it. We must continue the struggle. We have to do this on a daily basis. And I call on my white brothers and sisters to lead in this regard. Racism does not change when all the black folk are in the street. You must step forward, have the conversations with friends, family, loved ones, elected officials, and those in power when black folk aren't around. And that is how this changes, just like the folks on the jury in this regard and many of the folks who've walked, as Monica Cannon Grant would call them, not as allies but as accomplices, those who actually truly walk with you and they go down with you if something happens.
800-423-8255 to join this conversation. Where is your heart this week, listeners? How are you reacting? Are you okay? Has it been a hard week? 800-423-8255. So, Tom, you and I are two of Tito's white brothers and sisters, and he's calling white America to action here. I think about there is police reform in the process of being enacted in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. There's police reform in the process of being enacted in the city of Boston. There's, as former Governor Deval Patrick pointed out on Morning Edition earlier this week, police reform languishing in the U.S. Senate. Where are the steps on a policy level that white America can take the lead on to make the kind of change you, I heard, calling for before the break? And what policies can have teeth right now to start this change?
It's a hard question because I don't think policies can produce virtuous behavior. And I think Tito's right that this begins with not just white Americans, but Americans, but especially white Americans talking to each other and saying, you know, we have to have a change of heart. Good policies come out of a virtuous society. Good policies cannot make a virtuous society. And so I sometimes feel like I don't have a good answer to that because I feel like I'm just left saying we need to be better people. We need to be better to each other. With all that said, I think the outcome of those conversations also has to clear away some of the impediments that allow us to be worse people than we should be or are capable of being. And again, I think it's the institutions that where the first instinct is to protect the institution rather than to protect the public. So, you know, the kind of policies I would not, again, I don't want to prejudge policies that I worked in the Massachusetts legislature. I know how hard it is to write legislation, and I don't want to prejudge policies that people are going to have to work hard on and think about late. But I think the question should always be, are we writing policies that are for the good of the public, or are we writing policies that are for the good of the institution? This is why I brought up unions earlier. This is why I brought up things like creating separate commissions that can look at things like disclosure so that there isn't this giant air gap between the public and the institution, that there's some intermediate institution that we can create full of people of goodwill who say, look, we will mediate this. We will look at these issues and this kind of information as an honest broker in between police institutions or state institutions and an angry public. But I think all of it has to begin with goodwill and a decision to start being better and more civic people.
That resonates deeply. And one of the things I've been thinking about this week is local love, local leadership, and local action. I want to play sounds from two different people. The first is here in Boston, the 12th Baptist Church is going to conduct a service of healing and a call to action in response to the Chauvin verdict tonight. Here is Reverend Willie Bodrick of the 12th Baptist Church.
Our goal is to bring our city together, bring our Commonwealth together, and to hopefully through this worship experience that we can begin the steps towards healing and the steps towards doing better and reforming our system. But we can't do it apart. We have to do it together.
And I also want to play some sound from George Floyd's sister, LaTanya. Right after the verdict came down, and in the first half of this, she's referring to Derek Chauvin.
I'm going to pray for this man. I am. I'm going to pray for him. You know, that's not how our family, that's not how we do. But I'm going to tell you something. I was going to lose my life when I got that news. And like I said, to see him handcuffed and walk out of that courthouse like my brother was handcuffed, I told him he has no more power. He's not in control anymore, but my brother is in control.
I am not seeking, Tito, sort of an anodyne whitewashing of this to say, you know, can't we all just get along? And I recognize that both of the voices I just played are Black voices calling for grace and prayer. I do find myself thinking that it is, in fact, local behavior, local action, local people who seem to have the greatest chance to make change that will boil up. Is that naive?
I don't believe it's naive. And I think I saw a post the other day that says we are not trying to start a race war. We are trying to end one. As a people, that grieving sister still said she was going to pray for Derek Chauvin. The Right Reverend Willie Broderick is praying for Derek Chauvin as well as the community. But now Congresswoman Ayanna Pressley brings up regularly, African proverb says, when you pray, move your feet. We have to think about this issue of public safety as not merely being about police. Our safety in our communities is also about empowering people in the community. In the city of Boston in the 90s, there was this Boston miracle that wasn't only about the police. It was about clergy members, like the ones that we're talking about. It was about community-based organizations. It was about elders in our community, in particular, older ladies in our community stepping forward and making changes. It's also about, and what people don't hear when folks say defund the police, is in the city of Boston, we have nearly a 20% overtime budget in our police department that continues to go up. A couple things that we have to do to dismantle that. One, police should not be the primary force going to a mental health incident. They should be on standby, and we should have mental health workers. By the way, police need wellness. Let's also keep it 100 here when it comes to the fact that that is a stressful job, has become even more stressful, and we're not dealing with the very real issues of suicidality in policing. Right now, that is another really critical component. And this issue of truly connecting with police, one of the things that used to happen when I was first in the city council, we actually had safe street teams, which were bike units put in hot spots in and around the neighborhood. But the most important thing that they did was not policing. It was just simply speaking to people, connecting with folks. and having a baseline of connectivity, and that actually made those neighborhoods and communities safer. And so that's what it's about. It's not only about ice cream trucks, but it's actually about structural changes. And I would submit to you that the almost $80 million that was spent in overtime could much better be resourced in other proactive ways that don't lead to standoffs like we saw between fatal standoffs between Derek Chauvin and George Floyd.
Still with us this hour, The Atlantic's Tom Nichols and former Boston City Councilor Tito Jackson. For the rest of the hour, we're going to discuss the pandemic, speed of reopening in different states, politicization around vaccines, and whether it's not or not it's time to change some of our public health positions. 800-423-8255 is the number. That's 1-800-423-TALK. So some tension around reopening. Here is Governor Charlie Baker speaking yesterday. He was asked by a reporter if Massachusetts will further lift restrictions, like some neighboring states. Here he is.
Well, we've been following the public health data and the COVID data, and we continue to talk to our medical advisory board and to track some of the data that comes out of the CDC as well. I expect we'll have some stuff to say before the end of April, but at this point in time, people need to continue to follow the rules and the guidance. People need to continue to get tested, okay?
So a vague teaser there about potentially some change before the end of April. Tom Nichols, I was struck that we were going to have you this week because yesterday your state of Rhode Island joined the ranks of a bunch of other states announcing they're going to lift business restrictions in stages, but basically have them up in time for Memorial Day. So a juxtaposition there. What are your reactions?
Well, that that just swept in on the hubbub I was going to raise earlier about my adopted state here, here in Rhode Island, which is, you know, a good sign. But I think, and this actually links back to our earlier conversation about policing. One of the reasons I think people have dug in so hard about things like reopening is because it's become so politicized and it's become such a way of signaling one's politics that, you know, if you're a rugged individualist and a right winger, you're for opening. And if you're, you know, a namby-pamby liberal and, you know, communitarian, you're against reopening. And this is just silly. And the way it links back is that we have all developed a community that is in some ways too big. We all claim to love America. We just don't happen to like Americans or any of the Americans who live near us. I love America, just not anybody in my neighborhood. And, you know, and I'm not going to protect them or look out for them. I think that we've reached a point where we could probably come a lot closer to normality if we were behaving like sensible adults who are mature and responsible and take responsibility for our actions. And I'm hoping that that's where we get. But that's a long way around of saying I understand the hesitancy of elected officials to simply move toward reopening because there are so many people who are going to take that opportunity, you know, to do things that wouldn't be a good idea anyway. I mean, things that wouldn't be a good idea, you know, if it were just flu season, much less if we were facing a pandemic. So I understand the reticence of the elected officials, but I think it's time to pass the ball to the voters and to the public to say, you know, we're going to start trusting you to do the right thing and take our chances that way.
So there's so much in there I think we could dig into. Tito Jackson, I think the first thing I'll do is turn to you. You know, part of what's interesting about what Tom said in the politicization is that early on in this vaccination process, the dominant narrative was that people of color and communities of color were going to be and were vaccine hesitant, and that there was going to need to be work to be done to build trust and reduce that hesitancy. It has reduced. And now we see that the data is around white evangelicals nationally or Republicans nationally and locally. So that story has flipped. A, I find that interesting. And B, what to do about that?
Well, one, I want to give the Boston Black COVID-19 Coalition huge props. I want to give the medical director at the Reggie Lewis Center in Roxbury, Elena Stenson, huge props. And she's done amazing work around bringing Black doctors, trusted individuals into the community. And I also, you know, want to give kind of writ large, the conversation, knowing that these disparities around contracting COVID as well as dying from COVID. And I do want to note I am a COVID survivor. Luckily, I now have both shots. But when we have to understand that this is our commonality. Right? Those folks who were talked to, who trusted individuals, were connected with them. As Tom noted, you know, folks have issues with. I love this kind of comment around. We love America. We just have issues with Americans. I think there's really something there. I think what we bridge back to is one. This is a dynamic process, and we have to be data driven, and we have to take a data driven approach because you know what? Remember. In the very beginning, we were only supposed to shut down for 2 weeks. Remember that, Tiziana?
I do.
The curve was going to go down if we shut down for 2 weeks. And we have to take a real public health approach and listen to those who are in that space. In addition, this also shows that we are inextricably connected. We are family. And we are just as safe as the person who's least safe, who's least resource. Who has the least amount of information as well as access. And I think we still have to also continue to have a conversation with our evangelical brothers and sisters. This doesn't have to do with this topic, but Pat Robertson this week agreed with me on something, which was amazing. And so the fact that there are some things that are actually changing in the community, I think we have to continue to talk and help people understand it's not only about them as an individual, it's about their families, their friends, and their community as a whole, and we are all absolutely connected.
So, Tom Nichols, I want to play two pieces of sound from you from two different doctors we spoke with this week. The first is Dr. Benjamin Linus. He was on Tuesday, and we asked what it would take to convince those who are hesitant for political reasons not to get the vaccine.
It's going to take dialogue and talking to folks and listening and hearing what their concerns are and actually responding to those things. Simply screaming data and yelling at people they should do this is not going to work because it doesn't work in any other public health effort. It really does take the hard job of listening and responding and trying to find a dialogue and trying to find the narrative that generates trust.
And again, I want to clarify that was to convince people to get the vaccine. And so then yesterday on the show, we had, I thought it was very thoughtful, a conversation with Dr. Ashish Jha, who's Dean of the Brown University School of Public Health, about sort of public health steps, public health requirements and regulations, whether they work, when they should be changed. Here's an interesting piece of what he had to say.
One of the reasons, for instance, that I have been saying, you know, we really do need to start thinking about lifting certain restrictions is if they're not doing much for public health, then we probably should not be doing them at this point. And we may have thought 6 months ago they were doing a lot, but once we learned that they're not, we should begin lifting restrictions that do very little.
That was in part Tom Nichols, part of him advocating that it might be time to lift the outdoor mask mandate. And we know there's steam picking up there. I put those two things together to kind of explore the idea that people also are reacting to changes in what we say is important. Changes in what we say we're going to do, and then we do something else. I hate it when I'm not articulating the way I want to on live radio, but maybe you can bail me out here.
But I think the problem is that there are two groups of people who object to restrictions and two groups of people who are worried about vaccines. Some of them are folks who are just trying to do the right thing and who have legitimate, you know, concerns. I mean, I had an elderly member of my family who really was a little worried, you know, could I get really sick from this? Is the vaccine a problem? You know, eventually, with some discussion and education and patience, she's like, yeah, I should do this thing. The problem is there's an entire cadre of people, this is where I part company with the first clip you played, who are just doing this in bad faith as a matter of politics. And I can only speak for myself here. I am done trying to argue or cajole or coddle or generally, you know, make people feel better about resisting these public health issues when what they're really engaging in is demonstrative and performative attention seeking. You know, argue with me all day long. I'm not going to do it anyway. I was really struck by a focus group I think Frank Luntz convened a focus group of people who said, there were people literally said, well, if there are vaccine passports, I'll just get a fake one. You know, at some point you stop arguing with such people and you stigmatize them. When I was a boy, and I'm sure many of people listening had this same experience, we all took the polio vaccine because we were all scared to death of polio and we eradicated it. Could you imagine in 1965 saying, well, I'm not taking the polio vaccine. You go ahead and do it if you want to. I don't know about your neighborhood. My neighborhood, people would have said, you're a bad citizen. You're a bad neighbor. And, you know, this is really unconscionable. And I am tired of people saying, well, I want to be a bad neighbor, a bad citizen, and I want you to argue with me endlessly because I enjoy the attention and the emotional negative energy that I create by doing that. So I think it's great to reach out to people, you know, again, like my elderly, you know, family members and say, look, these are the numbers. This is, we're all going to do this together. We're going to get it done. Tito, congratulations. I've had my second shot too, feeling good. You know, but at some point we have to draw a line and start instituting social guardrails that says, no, you are not, if you are going to behave this way, you are not welcome here. You know, if you're going to express these views, I am not going to pretend that these are legitimate views. This is a bad faith argument, and we have to deal with the reality of that as well.
So there, you know, that's a bit of a manifesto, which is why I love doing Week in Review, because it allows us to bring so many of these thoughts together. Tito, I think I'm going to go to Hubbubs in a second, but before I do, is there anything that you want to add to that? There's a lot from Tom there to think about.
And there is, and I think one thing I want to add is the interesting phenomena of Trump is that a lot of these white folks, in particular in the South, have been left behind by this economy, and so some of what we're seeing is saying that the system hasn't worked for me. And this is rage against the machine relative to that. And they have not been willing to, and by the way, it obviously wasn't working for them under Trump, and it probably was able to kind of weaponize these folks where people are really and have voted outside of their own interest. And so I think one of the manifestations, and I think Tom alluded to some of this, but is simply that these folks are feeling left out. And they feel as if this is a political battle rather than a battle with a virus. And I think there's really something to be said about having that level of understanding when you're approaching folks. And I think to Tom's point, we have to do something that we haven't done in the past 4 years. We got to keep talking to folk, keep speaking to folk who we don't agree with. And some of those people, not all, have come around and seen that we actually do have some caring and connectivity for them, and will continue to move forward to do the right thing. Some of them will never be there, but I think we have to keep that open.
All right. Well, we will keep talking here on Radio Boston. I blew past our hubbubs, but that's okay because I stole Tom's anyway. So that was Tito Jackson, former Boston City Councilor, now CEO of Verdant Medical, and Tom Nichols, Professor of National Security Affairs at the U.S. Naval War College in Newport, Rhode Island, and a contributing writer for The Atlantic. Thanks to both of you. That was
awesome.
Fun.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, listeners, that is our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Thanks for listening. Thanks for calling. I'm Tiziana Deering. Have a good weekend, and then join us again on Monday for more Radio Boston.